By a show of hands, how many of you are married? Yeah. How many of you are married right here? A lot of you are married right here. How many of you are planning? It's like on your calendar to get married. Some engaged couples. Okay, that's kind of cool. We're going to talk about marriage today. We're going to talk about marriage. I recognize not everybody is married. My kids have already warned me out about it. They said, Dad, we're not coming to church. I said, why not? He said, you're talking about marriage. It's got nothing to do with us. I'm 12. I said, well, one day you will be. Maybe you'll get it right the first time. You should probably show up. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about marriage because we're in the middle of a sermon series called Relationships. We're talking about cultural shifts that impact the way that we relate to one another. And oftentimes that manifests itself in an old-fashioned covenant called marriage. Now, I recognize not everybody is married, but maybe this will inform you as well, because I think the same dynamic happens to those of you who aren't married, you know, some kind of significant relationship. And I think what we'll talk about really does probably impact everybody. I have the privilege of doing some weddings. I don't do nearly as many as I used to do. We got about 14 clergy. We kind of divide and conquer, but I do a handful. I think it's important to stay grounded and connected to the congregation, and weddings are special. They're very, very special. And not just the wedding, but I like the planning up to part. I love it when young couples, sometimes they're not young, they're just couples, they come to see me, and we talk. We talk about their marriage and what they hope and what they dream. And they're always pretty vulnerable. They're always pretty vulnerable and transparent and honest. They talk about with such wide-eyed purpose and vision about what their marriage is going to look like. And they say, this is what we hope, and we want to live here, and we want to do this, and this is the way we're going to divide up our holidays, and this is how we want to raise our children. And they share, this is what I hope my wife will be like, and this is how I hope my husband greets me when I walk through the door. And they just open up, and they pour out all of these hopes and dreams with such utter transparency. I had a young guy one time, I said, what are you looking forward to in your marriage? He said, I will be able to be physically intimate twice a day. I said, that is a fantasy, pal. That ain't gonna happen, but good luck, you know? But that's the moment, is so sensitive, and they just have all of these hopes and these dreams and this picture of what their marriage is going to be like. And my prayer is always the same. I pray and I hope that their bucket full of hopes and dreams and desires never becomes a bucket full of expectations. And it almost always does. I don't know what happens. I don't know if it's at the altar. I don't know if it's after they walk down the aisle. I don't know if it's on the honeymoon. I don't know if it's a day later, a year later. But it almost always happens. When we get married, we take a bucket full of legitimate hopes and dreams and desires and things that we love talking about and planning for. And wouldn't it be great if, and that bucket somehow, some way, gets converted to a bucket full of expectations. And what we used to hope for, now we expect. After all, this is what a good husband ought to do. And I know this is what a wife is supposed to do. And without even knowing it, we convert marriage from a covenant to a contract. And so often it becomes nothing more than a transactional relationship. You need to meet my expectations. And all I know, and I see it happen all the time, when this transition happens, and it almost always does, the dynamic in marriage is changed instantly. For starters, the romance and the intimacy are out the door. Once a marriage is converted from a covenant to a contract, intimacy, romance, they evaporate. As you move from covenant to contract, you move from an unconditional love paradigm to a paradigm that involves a debtor relationship. And here's what we say, when we convert our hopes and dreams into expectations, what we're saying without saying it is, you owe me. You owe me. This is what a good husband should do. You owe me. This is what a wife is supposed to do. You owe me. You're the provider and you owe me. You're the caretaker and you owe me. Now, all of us in this room could build a strong and a convincing case as to why we think our spouses owe us. After all, they promised. They promised right here at the altar. And we promised. So we justify that they owe us. And as justified as you may feel, as justified as I have felt many, many times, I'm sure Ashley has the same. You still end up with a debt-debtor relationship. And anytime it devolves to a debt-debtor relationship, the intimacy and the romance are out the door. There is no longer margin for the expression of or the reception of unconditional love. After all, think about it. If your expectation is this, fill in the blank, and the expectation is met, why would you give credit or gratitude for something that they're just supposed to do? And that's what happens subtly, but painfully. If they just meet expectations, why would you bother giving them credit? After all, they're just up to par. They're just up to zero. That's what you were just supposed to do. Once I expect it and you do it, you've just done what I expected. Why would I throw a party for that? Why would I go out of my way to demonstrate gratitude for that? You don't give credit for things that you just expect. That's why you never in your life have received a perfume sprayed, calligraphy written, handmade note full of love from your mortgage lender when you made your last payment. Did you? No. You know why? They just expected it. That's what the contract says. That's what you're supposed to do. In fact, the only time you get personal attention from the bank, right, is when you miss a payment. You ever try to call your bank? Right? You get all kind of recordings and push one and then two and then three and then speak and then da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You can't even get through to anybody. You miss a payment, they'll call you. I know this, right? They will call you. You get special attention when you have messed up. And many of you in this room right now are experiencing that in your marriage. You only get special attention when you mess up. You deliver all the good stuff, and there may be some peace, and it may be pretty good, a lot of pleasantries. It may be okay, but not a lot of celebration because they just expect that. But when you don't meet an expectation, whoa, that's when the special attention comes out. As long as you do everything right, it's peaceful, but it's not a lot of love. But when you mess up, now is when we need to sit down and talk. And if you're in that environment, nobody feels love, do they? It's just transactional. You feel defeated, like you're not meeting expectations, or you feel defeated because they're not meeting your expectations. And either way, you just kind of plod the course. You don't need me to tell you that's not a marriage. That's an expectation management system. And too often that's what we devolve into. And we're in this series called Relationships. We're talking about a lot of cultural shifts. We talked on the first week that we now communicate in ways that we've never communicated before. And we have to adjust to that shift. Texting, right? Lack of presence. And last week we suggested that we're more connected now than ever, but we're lonelier than ever. Why? Because human relationships are not about being connected. They're about being invested in one another. And there's another cultural shift. Sociologists will tell you, they will tell me, that study after study after study, that we now expect more from our spouses than we ever have. We want our spouses to be and do everything. You have to look good, you have to act right, you have to provide, you have to bring money to the table, you have to support the children in the way that we agreed upon. You have to do everything. This is how sociologist Esther Perel says it. Marriage used to be an economic institution in which you were given a partnership for life in terms of children and social status and succession and companionship. But now we want our partner to still give us all of these things, but in addition, I want you to be my best friend, and I want you to be my trusted confidant, and I want you to be my passionate lover. And by the way, we live twice as long. So we come to one person now and we basically are asking them to give us what once an entire village and community used to provide. Honey, I expect you to bring money and income to the bottom line and to take care of the kids and to look like a model and to be healthy and to treat me a certain way. We expect men to provide and be present and be rugged and be sensitive. We expect so much. And when our expectations are not met, we really only have a few options. Option number one, you leave. You leave. You leave because you crater under the weight of failing to meet expectations. You can't handle it anymore. You're tired of coming home defeated, or the reverse. You're so tired of them not meeting your expectations, you're going to go find somebody that can. And if your relationship is built on expectations and they don't measure up, we now live in a world culturally that will present more options to you for somebody that you think can meet your expectations. The dating business online is about a $2.4 billion industry. Now, I'm not saying the dating business is a bad thing. In fact, it's probably a wonderful way to meet people. But I'm always alarmed and amazed at the same time about how much of it is populated by married people trying to find someone that can meet their expectations. Our marriages have become frighteningly dispensable. We have more options now than we have ever had romantically. You carry around in your pocket a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week singles bar. It's right there on your phone. More romantic options than ever. It is so easy to get frustrated with somebody that can't meet our expectations and to leave. If your husband doesn't look like George Clooney and take out the trash on time and can't afford to fly you to Paris for Valentine's Day, guess what? There are 50 guys right now on Match.com whose profile says they will. It's easier than ever to leave. Option number two, sometimes the stronger partner wins. Both sides have expectations. There's always a dominant partner. And the dominant partner finally explains after conversation and lecture and lecture and lecture that you're just not meeting expectations, and so you just surrender and say, okay, I'll just try my best to do whatever it is you need. And that's not healthy either. Third one is we compromise. Compromise in and of itself is not a bad word. In fact, it's probably a pretty good word, but sometimes it's not the healthiest way to have a marriage. Now, is it? Compromise means you do your part, I'll do my part, but we're committed to the marriage. I meet a lot of people. Why are you still together? We're committed to the marriage. Let me explain. The Bible doesn't call any of us to be committed to a marriage. It calls us to be committed to a person. That's different. Marriage is the means to the end. The commitment is about the person, not the marriage. If you're just committed to the marriage, it's probably pretty shallow. It's probably ordinary. It's probably not thriving. But can you imagine if it were? Can you imagine if we could get back to a place where we took all of our expectations and we put them back in the box that says dreams and hopes and desires? Could you imagine if we quit dwelling in the world of expectation and we got back to having fun talking about what if we could live our lives like that? I happen to think it's possible. Can you imagine coming home, not having to feel the burden of expectation? Every time you walk in the door, that you've got to honor some kind of transaction, you've got to live up to some kind of standard that you can never live up to. And can you imagine not being distressed all the time because your spouse isn't living up to your standards? And I think it's possible. I think it's possible, or we wouldn't be in the business of doing marriages. But it's a covenant. It's not a contract. And not only is it a covenant, but it's not a covenant between two people. There's actually a third party involved, and that's what we too often forget. And way back in the Old Testament, There's a wonderful piece of literature called Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes was written by a guy named Solomon. Solomon, the history in the Bible would tell us, is the wealthiest person who has ever lived in the history of the world. Solomon, right? He succeeded his son, King David, and he ruled over Israel about 1,000 years before Christ. And Solomon, at the end of his life, said, you know, I have seen some things, and I want to share them. And through some divine inspiration, Solomon began to document that. He put them in a text called Ecclesiastes, which just means gathering. It's a gathering of wisdom. And if you've never read the Bible, I think this is a great place to start. The Bible's confusing sometimes. Sometimes you think, well, I don't even know if I know if the Bible is true. I happen to think it's true. But look, even if you don't think it's true, I can tell you this, it works. If you're just practical, start in Ecclesiastes and just see what you think. And this is what Solomon talks about. He talks about a lot of things, but he talks about relationships. And in particular, he gives us a math lesson. And I've shared this at probably every wedding I've ever done. Ecclesiastes 4, verse 9. Two are better than one. It's the way God made us, to be in relationship. Two are better than one. Why? Because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up. Well, that makes sense. If you fall down by yourself, sometimes it's tough to pick yourself up, but if you've got someone there, they can pick you right up. It's a simple but effective word picture here. But pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. Simple but profound. Also, Solomon says, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. All of this is so practical. He's talking about the benefits of living your life committed to another person. Practical benefits. And all couples love to hear this because it validates their marriage. It validates their choice. Two are better than one, and I found the one, and oh boy, I am so excited. Let's go to the church. But there is a third party. And as many times as I've read this, couples never, ever pay attention to it. But it is the last line, verse 12. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. Whoa, wait a minute. You just spent the whole paragraph talking about the benefit of one and one. Where's this third cord? I don't even know what you're talking about. I get the one falling down and the other one helping them up. And that sounds pretty good. And I get the one laying alone cold, but with another one, they're pretty warm. And I get the one being attacked, but with support, they're defensible. I get all of the third cord. What are you talking about? Solomon says this is so important. It's the third cord that makes the strand unbreakable. Well, what's the third cord? The third cord is God. The third cord is God. A two-cord strand is easily breakable. It might be nice, it might work from time to time. It's beneficial, but it's breakable. That's why you can come in here and spend all this money and tell the whole world in front of God and everyone that this is the person you love the most, and then inside of a week or a month or a year, determine that that same person that you love the most is now the person that you hate more than anyone else on the planet Earth. A two-cord strand is totally breakable. It is the third cord that makes it hard to pull apart. Our problem is we tend to assign our expectations to the first cord. Why would we give expectations to the cord that can't meet them in the first place? And Solomon says, that's the point. There is a third cord. Don't assign expectations to the one cord that can't meet them in the first place. In other words, a spouse can only do so much. Did you know that? We can only do so much. A spouse can only do what a spouse can do. A spouse cannot do everything. That's why the third cord is so vital. And let's talk for a minute about what a spouse cannot do. A spouse cannot fix you. Sometimes people are just messed up before they get married. Guess what? They get married, they're still messed up. Somehow they lean on that one cord to fix them. And then they get frustrated. And then they begin to blame. Your spouse cannot fix you. They are not wired to fix you. They are not wise enough to fix you. They are not capable enough to fix you. They are not empowered by God to fix you. Only the third cord can fix you. That's the role of the third cord. I see couples all the time in distress because one of them is reliant on the other one to fix them. That kind of cord is totally breakable, and more often than not, breaks. The third cord, that's where we assign that expectation. Our God is a healer. Our God is a fixer. Our spouse is not. A second dilemma, your spouse can't complete you. I don't know who invented that. You complete me, right? No, they don't. They can't. All of us have a God-sized and a God-shaped hole in our hearts, and your spouse cannot and will not and will not ever fill it up. Only God can complete you. Stop relying on your spouse to do something they cannot do. Paul said it this way in his letter to the Corinthians. For now, we see only a reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know only in part. I am totally incomplete. But then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. How? In a relationship, not with my spouse, but with the third cord. When we rely on our spouse to complete us, we're walking down a road of illusion. Only God can do that. Third thing is this may irritate some of you, but your spouse can't make you a better person. That's another thing I hear all the time. They make me a better person. No, they don't. They may encourage you to be a better person. They may lead you in a direction where you can be a better person. They may include you in environments where you can be a better person, but they cannot make you be a better person, just like they cannot make you be a worse person. We make our own decisions. Only God, with our cooperation, can make us a better person. The point of all this, we shouldn't expect our spouse to do what only God can do. That kind of arrangement is breakable. But when we allow God to invade our relationship and wrap His love and His grace and His mercy and His wisdom and His Spirit around our relationships, that's when it becomes unbreakable. We shouldn't expect our spouses to do what only God can do. We gotta work and try hard to take our focus and our expectations off of Him and off of her and put them squarely on the one source that can do it, and that is the third cord. Now look, I'm not naive, and I know the pushback, and everybody can stand up right now and you can tell me your story, say, this doesn't apply to me, Paul, you don't know my husband. This doesn't apply to me, Paul, you don't know my wife. You can't give her $5 or else and you just fill in the blank, right? If my husband doesn't have a 2-foot lease and all blank breaks out in our home, and you don't understand. I have heard it all. No one's ever called me and come by my office to tell me how great their marriage is doing. Ever. Never happened. But the line is long for those that say, you don't know how bad. And look, I'm not talking about staying in an abusive relationship. Let me be clear about that. But I've heard all the stories. They say, well, Paul, you and Ashley might be happy, but you know, you're a pastor and all that, and you read the Bible and all that. I'm telling you, you don't know my husband. I've heard it all. I can tell you, your only hope is not that they'll somehow meet your expectations. It's that you'll invite God to do what only God can do. And you'll allow God to invade your relationship. You say, okay, well, wait a minute. What am I supposed to do then with all these expectations? Can I sit around and I'm out, I just whatever, and they're just gonna do whatever they do, and I shouldn't expect anything? What do I do with all? Look, the Bible has an answer to this. Peter, who was married and who knew Jesus and was trying to figure out what it meant to live a Christian life, wrote these words, 1 Peter 5, all of you, who? All of you, clothe yourselves with humility towards one another. That's the answer. Clothe yourself with humility. I got all these expectations, they're not being met. What do I do? Clothe yourself with humility. Well, why? Because God opposes the proud, but shows favor to the humble. That's how you invite the third cord in, by showing humility. Now, biblical humility, let's talk about that. That's not, you have higher rank than me, so let me bow down to you. That's not, you're a general and I'm a sergeant, therefore I'm so humble in your presence. That's not biblical humility. Biblical humility is you have a deal and I have a deal. And I'm gonna put your deal before my deal. That's biblical humility. You have a deal, I have a deal. And when we're together, I'm gonna put your deal in front of my deal. And I'm telling you, when both couples discover this, that's when marriage becomes the covenant it's supposed to be. When your deal is more important than my deal. And Peter says, this is the paradigm in which our relationships work best. When you clothe yourself with humility, why? Because God opposes those who don't. If you choose not to, that's okay. But don't expect the third cord to wrap itself around your life. God says, oh, you're not gonna put their deal before your deal, then I'm gonna sit over here and I'm gonna resist you. But if you wanna be humble, I'll favor you. I want God to favor my marriage. Peter says the only way that happens is through humility. And Peter wrote this letter to a community, and he says this is so important for those who are willing to freely put someone else's deal before those, that God resists the proud, but he favors those who are willing to do this, to invite the third cord, is to be humble. He gives grace to the humble. That's what Peter says. He gives grace to the humble. Favor, grace. And this isn't kind of salvation grace that gets you into heaven. This is the grace that empowers you to do what you need to do while your expectations are not being met. That's what this kind of grace is. But they never meet my expectations. Humble yourself, put their deal before your deal. And the promise Peter says will happen is you will be provisioned with grace. Grace, the strength, the power, the wisdom, the patience to do what you need to do in the moment while you need to do it when your expectations are not being met. This is what happens when we humble ourselves. God gives grace and favor to the humble. He goes on, verse 6, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. And we struggle sometimes with that last little phrase there, in due time. We don't like due time. We like our time. We like now time. But Peter says the promise is that God will provision you to do what you need to do. With all those anxieties about unmet expectations, he will give you the grace to respond lovingly and appropriately. And he will be working in due time. He goes on, verse 7, so cast all of your anxiety on him because he cares for you. So what I think that means is you take all that anxiety, all that frustration, all that angst, all that you're not meeting my expectations, and you put it on the one who can. And God says, bring it on. I'm inviting you to bring it on. It's a daily dump. Bring it to the third cord. And I've seen this so many times. Marriages that were on the rocks are somehow salvaged miraculously. And I think, why? Because God suddenly favored the humble. And in due time, for those who cast all of their pressures on the right cord, the strand became unbreakable. And some of you could stand up here right now and you could tell your story and it would put this sermon to shame because you've seen this lived out in your life. And so my prayer for everybody that's married, everybody in a significant relationship, everybody that wants to get married, will think about these truths and we'll stop converting all of our hopes, dreams, and desires into expectations that simply lead to a disastrous transaction. Marriage is not just to be survived. It is something God blesses us with to thrive. And there is a way for that to happen. But it involves a third strand. Let's pray. Heavenly, gracious, and loving God, would you give us the awareness and would you give us the willingness to embrace you as the third party in our relationships? For all of us, Lord, that are struggling because expectations are not being met, would you fulfill the promise and provision us with your grace as you work behind the scenes in due time? Would you favor us? And would you help us to cast our anxieties in the meantime, not upon the one who cannot meet them, but upon the Lord who can and longs to? In your son's name we pray. Amen.